Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Hello everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors, episode 41. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger. As always, I'd like to begin by thanking the wonderful patrons who continue to support this podcast. I'm so very grateful for your encouragement and generosity. A full list of patrons is available on my website under the Patrons tab. If you love Talking Tudors and would like to show your appreciation and support the work I do, just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family and you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways, as well as receiving some other wonderful perks. July's prize is a copy of Unleash Your Inner Tudor, Henry VIII's inspirational guide to a completely sizzling, sparkly, tyrannical, much wider, demanding and sexier you, by none other than Henry VIII, also known as Andy Dembski. A huge thank you to Andy for sponsoring this wonderful prize. Now, on to today's episode. I'm thrilled that joining me on the show to talk about her book Black Tudors is Dr. Miranda Kaufman. Dr. Kaufman is the author of the critically acclaimed book Black Tudors, The Untold Story. She's a senior research fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies, part of the School of Advanced Study, University of London, where she's been co-convening the popular What's Happening in Black British History series with Michael Ohajuru since 2014. She's also an honorary fellow of the University of Liverpool and a fellow of the Royal Historical Society. Miranda read history at Christchurch, Oxford, where she completed her doctoral thesis on Africans in Britain, 1500 to 1640 in 2011, and where she also won two blues for rugby. Miranda is currently conducting research towards her next book, Heiresses, the Caribbean Marriage Trade. My conversation with Dr. Kaufman straight after this short musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sayles. Welcome to Talking Tudors, Miranda. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I'm really looking forward to chatting with you. I thought we could begin by you just introducing yourself to our listeners and maybe just telling us a little bit about your background.
Okay, hi everyone. My name's Miranda, Dr. Miranda Kaufman. I'm a historian. My first book, Black Tudors, came out back in 2017, which was based on my doctoral research at Oxford. My thesis was called Africans in Britain 1500 to 1640. So we got a snappier title for the book. I'm also a senior research fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies in London, where I co-organise a series with my colleague Michael Ohjuru called What's Happening in Black British History. So I'm really interested in that more broadly and getting that taught and having a kind of people being more aware of the fact that there have been black people in Britain since Roman period. So Black Tudors is only a kind of part of that longer story. I've recently been working with some school teachers to get Black Tudors into the classroom, and I seem to have a million other things that I'm doing.
Yes, and I want to ask you about the school project a little bit later on. But so have you always been interested in Tudor history, or is this something sort of fairly new?
Oh no, it goes pretty far back. My parents always took me to lots of historic sites and museums, so I was always interested in history in general. And I was first taught the Tudors when I was about 9 at primary school, and I had a really great history teacher, and I remember her sitting on the edge of her desk in the afternoon telling us stories from history, and I remember her telling us about Elizabeth I and Henry VIII and the singeing of the King of Spain's beard by Francis Drake and all that. So it goes pretty far back. And also I used to watch loads of history films with my dad as well, like Young Bess or Anne of a Thousand Days or all these sort of Tudor dramas. So it runs deep.
Okay, thank you. And you mentioned your book, Black Tudors, The Untold Story. I'd love to hear a little bit more about this particular book. And also, maybe if you could just share with us why you felt this was a book that needed to be written.
Well, like I said, the book came out of my doctorate. So when I was researching, I was really surprised to find out there were Africans living in Tudor England. And put a lot of hard work into finding them. So then I wanted everyone to know about it. Yeah. I found records of sort of over 360 individuals living here between 1500 and 1640. That's in England and Scotland. And so I wanted the world to know. But also I think it's really important, firstly because it happened, but also because we quite often have quite a narrow vision of Tudor history. We get sort of caught up with the admittedly very dramatic and entertaining history, personal lives of mostly of Henry VIII and Elizabeth I. But actually, this was a period where England was beginning to develop a relationship with the wider world. England's history at this period is very tied up with this rivalry of Spain, but because the Spanish Empire is already an empire on which the sun never sets, the English are getting involved in that, and people like Francis Drake are sailing to the Caribbean, for example, to raid Spanish ports. So it's not just a Eurocentric story. But also, in Britain today, unfortunately, we have a very vituperative immigration debate going on. And I think a lot of people who want various people to go back where they came from, unfortunately, yes. Very familiar line at the moment, thanks to stuff going on in America. Those people quite often assume that immigration is a very modern phenomenon, that in England there's a sort of obsession with the Windrush, which was a ship that docked here from the Caribbean in 1948. And there's often this sort of assumption that immigration was really just a 20th century phenomenon and that the Tudor period was lily white, and it wasn't. So I think it's really important to show people this kind of long history of immigration in our island, and so hopefully sort of change their perspectives on that.
Absolutely. And could you tell us a little bit about how Africans actually came to be in Tudor England?
Yeah, so as I was saying, it's partly to do with our relationship with Spain, but In the middle of the 16th century, English merchants start trading with Africa for the first time, initially with Morocco, but then quite quickly going down the coast of West Africa to Guinea and other parts of West Africa. They first go to South Africa at the beginning of the 17th century, or sort of on the way to the East Indies with these sort of first East India Company voyages. And so when they go to Africa, they bring Africans back to England, teach them English, usually in London, and then take them back to where they came from to act as trade factors and interpreters, because obviously they need to be able to communicate with the African merchants. And at that point, they're tending to buy things like, they want gold, ivory, a kind of special kind of pepper called Malagueta pepper that was very abundant in what was called the grain coast. And so that's the sort of first route. And then because the Spanish and Portuguese already had this empire, as I said, there was a much higher proportion of African people in southern Europe than there was in northern Europe. Some parts of sort of southern Spain, like Seville, had up to, or Lisbon in Portugal, had sort of almost 10% of the black population. When merchants came to England from Portugal or Spain, or sometimes from parts of Italy, they sometimes brought Africans with them in their households. And that's also true for sort of monarchs. So when Catherine of Aragon comes over to marry Prince Arthur in 1501, or when Philip II of Spain comes over to marry Mary Tudor, they both have Africans in their entourage. And then the third way is through privateering. So as I was saying, people like Francis Drake, but also like huge amounts of other lesser known individuals, you get a much quicker profit than traditional trade if you took a privateering ship. So privateering is different from piracy, only that in that you have an official letter from the king or the queen saying that it's okay.
Right.
The logic is, it usually happens when England is at war with another country, but England was at war with Spain for quite a long period.
Yes.
So the idea being that, say the Spanish had already captured some English merchandise, so it was totally fine to go and capture their ships and take it back. And also, Drake actually sort of starts raiding Spanish ports in the Caribbean as well, as part of a broader strategy to sort of win the war against Spain. So again, because the Spaniards and Portuguese have been taking Africans across the Atlantic to work in their colonies since the early 16th century, when the English capture Spanish or Portuguese ships or raid Spanish ports in South America and the Caribbean, then they're quite likely to encounter Africans, and quite often quite a few Africans then come back to England in that way. So those are the three main ways.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. So how were they actually treated by the communities, like when they're living in England? Do we have much information about that?
Well, not as much as I'd like.
No.
But I think we can see quite a lot from the way that they're treated by the church, for example. So there are quite a few Africans. I think I found at least 66 Africans who were baptized in the period. And then there's a few who get married, and various others that receive Christian burial. So they're accepted as sort of equals in the eyes of God into the parish community, which is quite powerful because it's such a religious period. Everybody really believes, or at least has to appear to be believing, in the Protestant faith. So accepting Africans into that is quite significant, especially when we look at later periods when that was not a given at all. And actually, sort of when you get to sort of the 18th century, British slave colonies, that the enslavers are very resistant to baptizing the enslaved because it's sort of tied up with ideas of freedom. So these baptisms, I think, are highly significant. We can also see that these Africans are being paid wages, so they're sort of being valued in that way. they're allowed to testify in court.
Right.
So they have that kind of citizen status of, you know, being witnesses in trials. So they actually appear to have sort of fairly sort of reasonable status in the society. You know, sometimes they're highly skilled. Mm-hmm. Silk weaver, salvage diver, of needle maker. So they have skills that, you know, and that sort of gives them some status in society.
Yeah, definitely. So I spoke recently to one of the curators at the Mary Rose Trust, and they were speaking about the diver that you mentioned. I can't remember what his name was, but that it was an African diver that salvaged, they attempted to salvage the wreck of the Mary Rose. So that was really fascinating.
Yeah, his name was Jacques Francis.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And again, we know about him because he testifies in the High Court of Admiralty case brought against his master for stealing tin. His master was a Venetian called Peter Powell of Corsi. So we get right into the nitty gritty of that. And, you know, there were a lot of Italian merchants in Southampton at the time, and they get into this big dispute. So we hear Jacques Francis's sort of mediated voice in the court records, which is quite exciting.
Yeah, that is exciting. So I recently, Miranda, watched a video of you on YouTube, and you were discussing your book, and in it you mentioned that whenever you tell people that you were studying Africans in Tudor England, they kind of automatically think that you were referring to slaves. Now, you've touched on this a little bit, can you talk to us about sort of slavery in Europe at this time, and maybe go into a little bit more depth as to the legal status of the African Tudors?
Yeah, so one of the key arguments of my book is that Africans were free in Tudor England.
Yes.
I've mentioned a couple of the indicators of that, baptism, being mm-hmm. paid wages, being allowed to testify in court, because, you know, in other societies where slavery does exist, enslaved people are not allowed to testify in court, for example. And there's also never any kind of statute law in England passed sort of legalizing slavery, which does happen in other countries. So in Portugal, you get some sort of 15th century legislation. There's sort of, you know, there's a clouded picture in some of the other countries, but clearly in Spain, Portugal and Italy, you have Africans who are enslaved there. And things are a bit different in Northern Europe, partly because there's a much smaller black population. France issues what it calls the Code Noir in the 17th century, but that's a bit later on. So I think, you know, there is this clear difference, and it's recognised by the people at the time as well. So you get sort of Spanish officials, other, you know, Africans themselves sort of commenting that that Africans are free in England. And so for example, a man called Diogo, who's an African brought to England by a pirate in 1614, and he says, you know, that immediately when he set foot on English soil, he became free. And there were free Africans in other places in Europe as well, that had been manumitted or sort of found their freedom. There were free people in other parts of Europe that had been manumitted and found their freedom, and again, sort of some of them reached some quite high statuses. But my argument is that in England at least, and Scotland, Africans were free.
Okay, now you mentioned that you found evidence of over 360 individuals of African descent living in England during the Tudor reign, and you focused on 10 people in your book. Could you tell us, you've told us a little bit about a couple there, could you tell us about a few of the other individuals that you came across?
Yeah, just to clarify, the 360 is up to 1640, so the early...
Right, okay.
Period as well. So about 200 of those are from the Tudor period. So let's see. Well, we start with John Blank, who's probably the most famous African Tudor, mostly because there's a picture. There are two portraits of him in this sort of rather wonderful document called the Westminster Tournament Roll, which is a 60-foot long vellum painting on vellum showing a tournament that Henry VIII put on in 1511. To celebrate the birth of a son who then died quite soon after. So we know John Blank. So John Blank's portrait in the Westminster Tournament Roll is actually the only portrait we have of an African in Tudor England. And so he played at that tournament. We think he probably came over with Catherine of Aragon in 1501. So he was playing at the court of Henry VII and then Henry VIII. He plays at Henry VII's funeral and then Henry VIII's coronation. And the only other thing we really know about him is that he got married in 1512 and Henry VIII sort of gives him a wedding present of some sort of fancy clothes to wear for his on his wedding day, and then he sort of disappears from the record. We've talked about the salvage diver already.
Yes, I
love the story of Diego, who circumnavigates the globe with Francis Drake, and also sort of negotiates a key alliance for him with these Maroons, so runaway, formerly enslaved people who've created their own settlements in the hinterland in Panama. And Diego negotiates this alliance between them and Drake, and they successfully capture a whole load of treasure from the Spaniards. And I really like the story of Dederi Jacar as well, because he's a prince. He comes from River Cestos in modern-day Liberia. So he's an example of what I was talking about before, when some Africans come to London and learn English and then go back again. So there's this quite funny scene in one of the letters from a merchant with the East India Company, and he sort of lands at this port in modern Liberia and is very, very surprised when an African approaches him and is speaking English to him. And he's like, what's that? You know, so that's quite interesting. And there were women as well in the book.
Yes, I was just going to ask you, yeah, any women?
There are. I think I've got three chapters about three different women in the book. There was a fourth that hit the cutting room floor because technically she never actually set foot in England.
Right.
We had to sort of, well, I incorporated her into a different chapter. She was on Drake's circumnavigation voyage as well. So if Drake's ship counts as English,
as English, yeah.
Anyway, so I've got a chapter on Mary Phyllis, who comes to London from Morocco, and we have a sort of extended record of her baptism at St. Botolph's Old Gate in 1597, which sort of tells us quite a lot about her. She starts out working in a sort of fairly wealthy merchant's household in London, but then she ends up moving. You know, and she moves household not when anyone dies, like, you know, not when her master or mistress dies or anything, but just a sort of some sort of given year. And so that sort of suggests to me that she had a choice about who she was going to work for. And she goes to work for somebody of sort of relatively low status, a seamstress called Millicent Porter, who lives in East Smithfield. So that's just outside the walls of the City of London. So it's a relatively poor area, but this woman is a seamstress. So my sort of speculation is that Mary Phyllis wanted to learn a trade, and, you know, had the opportunity to learn the art of dressmaking in Millicent Porter's household, because Millicent Porter probably only had one or two servants. So she would have had to sort of pitch in and help with the work. So I think that kind of puts her in a better position. And then, you know, she's 20 by the time she gets baptized. So the question is, sort of, why is that? Because she arrived in London as a girl, sort of 6 or 7. And again, I sort of speculate that maybe she wanted to get married, because of course you have to be a baptized Christian to get married in the Church of England. And there's another woman that I write about that people kind of seem to quite like, because she's so normal, so ordinary. Like, all we really know about her is there's this inventory of what she owned at her death. So she died without making a will, but because she had a certain number of possessions that are worth more than I think it was £5, you had, if you owned property more than £5 at your death, then they would draw up an inventory,
right,
and assign, you know, someone to decide what to do with it, really. And so we learn from that she's living in Almondsbury, which at the time was a small village outside of Bristol. It's now sort of been subsumed into the Bristol suburbs. She, you know, she has a cow, so her cow is her most valuable possession, which would mean that she, you know, she could make a livelihood from that. You know, she obviously could enjoy the milk and butter and cream herself, but then if she made enough, she could sell that to others. I found a sort of later example from the 18th century where it sort of actually said that the officials would actually give, if you were a poor woman looking for charity who needed support, they would actually give you a cow.
Right,
you know, sort
okay.
of a benefit system.
Yeah.
If they gave you a cow, that would sort of really help you along. So I was able to sort of sketch out a sort of sense of her life from what she owned. So you got a sense of sort of, you know, she had pewter candlesticks or whatever. So you could kind of sketch out her life that way. People were thinking about diversity in the Tudor period. They would, you know, they would expect that diversity in London, perhaps, but they wouldn't, you know, they don't, the idea of an African woman just sort of milking her cow on the village green is something that people really don't expect. And she, you know, that I found records of Africans in various sort of far-flung villages across the country, like Bluntisham Cum Erith in Cambridgeshire or Haverley. And you, people, yeah, people don't really, that's not really, doesn't really fit with people's preconceptions. So my book is all about smashing preconceptions.
Yeah, I love it. That day I was going to ask you whether they were mainly in Tudor London or whether they had, you know, moved around and settled in other places. So that's really great information. Now, you've mentioned some of the sources that you've used to research the lives, like the court records and the inventories. Was that, what other sort of sources did you use to glean all this wonderful information?
Yeah, so in terms of numbers, the most records are in parish registers. So those are records of baptisms, marials and burials. So that kind of gives us quite a lot of the numbers. But apart from, you know, Mary Phyllis is an exception because there's sort of three or four pages describing her baptism. But usually you just kind of get one line, like, you know, Mary, daughter of John, a blackamoor. And that's pretty much all that you get. So it's sort of things like the court records that are a bit meatier. But I also looked at sort of tax records. So there was an alien poll tax. So anyone from a foreign country had to pay 4 pence in extra tax. So again, you know, you get a few records that way. But again, they tend to be these sort of one-liners. There was a few wills, often where the Africans were actually beneficiaries of the wills, so their former masters were giving them legacies, you know, small legacies. Or I mean, one woman gets £10, quite
right.
a lot of the
That's
time,
quite a lot.
Or sort of clothing, or sort of basic, sort of, you know, just bits and pieces. So, but that's significant as well, because if these people were enslaved, the wills would be giving them to somebody else, whereas, you know, the wills that we find, they are receiving legacies. And, you know, you can't, and enslaved people, you know, don't tend to own property themselves, you know. So, you know, that's where Catalina's inventory is significant as well, as people leaving them things. And what else? There's quite a lot of sort of letters that mention Africans, you know, in the state papers, the government papers. There's discussion of, sometimes of Africans that have been brought back to England by privateers, or, you know, in a different sort of context, information about the Moroccan ambassadors that visited London in 1589 and 1600. So you just really kind of, I became sort of Jill of all trades. You know, most, quite often historians work with one set of archives, but I had to sort of spread myself more thinly and get to understand sort of more of a variety of different kinds of documents that survive.
Yeah, now I imagine that there were many eye-opening moments for you during your research. What's something that you discovered that really surprised you?
Yeah, well, I was saving this one up, so I didn't mention it when we were talking about some of the people. So the really, like, the most sort of shocking, really surprising moment was discovering that an African called Edward Swarthy, who was working as a porter in another sort of rural village in Gloucestershire, in a manor house belonging to Sir Edward Winter. So this man, Edward Swarthy, was probably baptised after his master, Edward Winter, is commanded to whip a fellow servant called John Guy in December 1596. So we have an African man whipping an Englishman, a white Englishman, and that of all the scenes in my book, you know, that is the paradigm shifting one, because it's not what we expect. To the point that, you know, when I first found the testimony from a court case that described this scene, the handwriting at the time is, you know, is quite tricky sometimes to decipher. And when I first saw Edward Swarthy's testimony, I couldn't really make very many words out to start with them. But the first one that sort of jumped out at me was whip with a double P. And I was like, oh God, a whipping. Right. And I immediately assumed that the African man would be being whipped. But actually he was holding the cudgel. So I was as surprised as anybody else. But I think that's a really important story to tell.
Absolutely. Yeah.
crazy thing about it is that then John Guy, the one who gets whipped, ends up becoming one of the first governors of Newfoundland.
Oh, right.
As well as like mayor of Bristol and an MP. And you know, some Canadians wrote a biography of him a little while ago, but they just didn't know about this early episode in his life at all. So he sort of left it out and sort of assumed that he'd grown up in Bristol. So he was born in Bristol, but then he obviously ends up serving in this Gloucestershire household, not that far from Bristol, but quite a long journey at the time. And then returns to Britain. So the whipping, he gets sacked. He was in quite a high status position as the manager of the ironworks. But yeah, he gets sacked. And at that point, he sort of goes back to Bristol and manages to sort of develop quite a prestigious career there.
Wow, that is fascinating stuff and not what you'd expect at all. I saw on Twitter that you've been working closely with some secondary schools, and you mentioned this a little earlier, to develop teaching resources to enable schools to teach their, you know, their kids about the lives of African tutors. Could you tell us a little bit more about this project, and if any schools want to get involved, how they do that?
Yeah, so I'm really excited about this because it really means a lot to me. And I spoke at a teaching conference run by the Historical Association last summer, and you know, it was great, but I afterwards sort of tweeted and I said, well, you know, are there any teachers out there who'd like to help me kind of do something more substantial with this to get black tutors into the classroom? And I had a really good response, sort of 20 to 30 people or something came back to me quite quickly. So I got their email addresses, started a mailing list, and we did a workshop last September with a group of teachers. We all got together for the day and sort of threw ideas around. And some of the teachers who came along had already been teaching black tutors. So we've just sort of been working on that ever since. Some of these teachers have actually taught black tutors this academic year. And we came together again at a different teaching conference a couple of weeks ago, and some of them sort of presented what they'd been doing to other teachers. And I did a sort of big speech myself, sort of barefacedly trying to convert these teachers to teach black tutors. And so we've already, some of these teachers have already uploaded their schemes of work and lessons plans to a Google Drive.
Right.
So you can find the link to that on my website. There's a blog I wrote a little while ago called Teaching Black Tutors, and there's a link on there. So if you Google Miranda Kaufman Teaching Black Tutors, it should all pop up. But you know, we're carrying on to develop it. We're going to have another workshop this autumn, and we're hoping to kind of polish those resources up and make them even more usable to any teacher out there, really. And it's not, I think one of our big things is we don't want it to be just sort of an add-on. So
yes,
I think a lot of people already teach the tutors, but ideally they wouldn't just do kind of one lesson on the black tutors and then move on again to their usual routine. But the stuff on the Google Drive has some examples of how you can kind of incorporate the black tutors sort of more generally to all the other things that you're trying to teach. So again, some of the big themes, so religion, the relationship with Spain, all of these things can be to all sorts of people talk. One of the things they're meant to teach, I think, is rural lifestyles, you know, the fact that the majority of tutors were living in villages and having, you know, quite quiet lives in the country.
Right.
So use sort of Catalina to talk about that. And I think it does give the children sort of something new and exciting to think about. And I mean, one of the things I wasn't expecting is an English teacher was very passionate about getting involved. And she, in my book, each chapter starts with a sort of short paragraph imagining a key moment in the individual's life. And she's given her kids some of those paragraphs and asked them to continue telling the story in their own words.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So it's really great. She shared some of the things they'd written and it was just amazing. So, I'm just blown away by where it's all gone, really.
Yeah.
So it's just great.
That's fantastic. And I'll add the link to the Teaching Black Tutors post into your website, then people can find it really easily if they'd like to get involved with that. So, Miranda, it's time to play our little game of 10 to go. That's the way we finish all our episodes. So just 10 not difficult questions at all, just to get to know you a little bit better. So are you ready?
I'm ready.
Excellent. So what's a favourite or most inspirational place to visit that's close to home for you?
Oh, close to home. I live in North Wales, Well, there's loads of great castles around here.
Yeah, that would be.
But I suppose a sort of special place that people don't really know about is somewhere called Gladstone's Library. And it's only about 10 minutes from me in a village called Harden. And so Prime Minister Gladstone, William Gladstone, had a load of books. during his career, he collected a lot of books. And when he died, his family weren't quite sure what to do with them all. And they actually sort of built a purpose-built library to hold them all. And, and it's got a sort of traditional reading room there, which reminds me of sort of the kind of libraries I found as a student in Oxford. They've built the collection from there. With the same sort of subject areas as William Gladstone was particularly interested in, like sort of theology, but also history. And it's a very quiet and kind of meditative place to work. I don't go there as often as I'd like to, but it's quite special. It's also the only residential library in the UK, so you can actually go and stay there. And they do offer scholarships, so you can, if you win the scholarship, you can go and stay there for free for a week or two. And I'm actually in the process of developing a Black British History scholarship with them there, so that would be great. Watch this space.
Yeah, fantastic. All right, favourite comfort food?
Ooh, I like so much different food. I think if it's really comfort, I think, just toast and butter. There's some really great bread. There's a bakery near here called Gerard's, and they make this amazing kind of brown seeded loaf, which is so good that I find it difficult to eat other breads.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah, toast a bit of that, have some butter, a cup of tea. If it's really comfort, I think if you need comfort, you definitely can't be bothered to actually cook anything.
No, that's right. So true, unless someone else cooks it. Yep, very true.
Absolutely basic. I do like cooking. I make all sorts of things. People like my white chocolate chip brownies.
Oh, yeah, that sounds good.
I successfully made some ice cream for the first time a couple of weeks ago. I got a recipe from a magazine and it had rose petals and raspberries.
Oh, wow. That sounds lovely.
The family devoured it in about 10 minutes.
Well, that's a good sign. Very good. All right. What was the last book that you bought?
Oh, gosh. I buy so many books.
I can imagine.
What's it called? I'm reaching for my bag. I was just in Scotland for a conference, so I got lots of reading suggestions. There's one right here called The Reaper's Garden: Ooh. Death and Power in the World of Atlantic Slavery by Vincent Brown. Going to Jamaica in just over a week.
So yeah, I saw that. That's exciting.
Need to do some preparatory reading.
Yeah, that is so exciting. How long are you going for?
I'm only going to be in Jamaica for about a week, but it's part of a trip. I'm going to Virginia as well to give a lecture there because it's 400 years since the first Africans arrived in Jamestown, Virginia. Well, they arrived at Point Comfort, and local historians are very keen to point out that they didn't arrive in Jamestown when they first set foot. It's very, it is significant to people, what spot exactly did these first Africans set foot on Virginian soil. Of course, in my book, I show that they weren't actually, we know that they weren't the first Africans to set foot in modern day North America. The Spaniards, the parts of sort of the American South that were Spanish at some point, Africans were with them in the sort of 1520s, 1530s. And then Diego, who's sailing with Francis Drake, sort of touches off California for a couple of weeks in 1579. But these ones in Virginia are the most significant because they become permanent settlers there. So I'm sort of going to be providing some context to that. In that very same year, 1619, one of the chapters I wrote about John Anthony, who was a sailor, and he actually set sail on a voyage to Virginia in that very same year. And if he had got there, he would have been the first African in Virginia, and he would have been a free wage sailor. So that would have been a different kind of story. But unfortunately, his voyage sort of only gets as far as Bermuda, because then they get hold of some tobacco and sail back to Europe. Okay. So they don't go all the way to Virginia in the end. But it's still an interesting contrast, that men like him were operating in the Atlantic world at that period. even though the first Africans in Virginia get sort of traded for victuals or food.
Mm.
So they obviously have a different status. And you know, I'll be in Jamaica researching for my next book. So
fantastic. Yes. So Miranda, I don't know if you watch a lot of television because you're a very busy lady, but name a show that you've either binge watched or maybe a movie that you kind of go back to.
That I go back to. I love watching telly. I watch all sorts of rubbish.
Good.
When I get the chance. You do need, well, I actually ended up watching Pitch Perfect.
Oh, did you?
That's from my conference. Although unfortunately I was, you know, because I'm sort of hypersensitive to this thing, I did notice some pretty racist jokes and dubious racial stereotyping in Pitch Perfect. So it's hard for me to enjoy it. Now I suppose my sort of my equivalent of sort of buttered toast is probably, it's difficult. I love the old Robin Hood with Errol Flynn.
Right.
I think he's pretty sexy, although he turned out to be a complete bastard in real life. Are you allowed to say that word?
You can say that word, yeah.
He actually spent some time in Jamaica, but was very naughty while he was there.
Uh-huh.
But also, so I love that. In fact, you know, I used the soundtrack from that on my wedding video.
Oh, did you?
But it's good. It's got a lot of kind of procession music in it and feasting music, so it works quite
well. Yeah, that's good.
But then there's the other one I love is The Princess Bride. I could watch that. You know, I've watched that a lot. Do you know what I mean, The Princess Bride?
I don't know that I've seen it, no.
You must. It's a sort of comic fairy tale. It's
I'm writing it down. The Princess Bride.
It sort of starts out with Fred Savage, who you might know from the Wonder Years.
Oh, yes, from the Wonder Years. I loved that.
He's a little boy, and he's stuck in bed because he's ill. He's bored, and his grandfather comes round to entertain him, and he's like, ugh, I'd rather play my computer games. His grandfather says, I'm going to read you a story, and he's very skeptical.
Mm-hmm.
But his grandfather turns out to be a masterful storyteller, and it's, you know, it's got everything. It's got princesses, it's got
giants, great
courtship, and it's got true love.
I'm going to watch it. I'm adding it to my list.
Some very good like one-liners or memorable quotes. So there's a Spanish guy who's trying to avenge his father, and he's trying to find the six-fingered man who killed him when he was a boy. And his line is, my name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die. and he just keeps on repeating that phrase while he's having this sword fight with the six-fingered man. Anyway, it gives you a flavour. You must watch it.
Yes, I like it. I think I'm going to really enjoy that. All right. Are you superstitious?
No.
No, you don't mind walking under ladders. You don't mind black cats. You don't mind any of that.
No, not that. I suppose, but I sometimes sort of feel like something was meant to be, or that.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know. Just very blessed when something kind of special happens, or I suppose I have a feeling for place. So
yes.
Maybe as a historian, you know, there are some places where you visit where you sort of feel, I don't know, connected to the people who lived there in the past.
Oh, yeah.
You feel like, you know, you're removed from the past by time and space. But if you go to the right space, then it's just time that separates you.
Absolutely. That's, exactly how I feel, actually. I can see that lots of things bring you joy, but what's something that, brings you lots of joy, makes you really happy?
Oh, well, the sound of my daughter's laughter.
Aww.
Daughters, plural.
Two daughters, yes.
Two daughters.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah.
Well, and when they give each other hugs, yeah.
Yeah, that's cute, isn't it? When they get along, that's always nice.
They're quite thoughtful to each other.
So. Oh, well, that's lovely. That's really nice. I think I might know what you're going to say to this one, but I'll ask you anyway. Name something that you're currently looking forward to. Maybe it's Jamaica.
Well, I'm actually I'm a bit nervous because I think it's just going to be boiling hot.
Oh, yeah, probably.
I'm probably more looking forward to coming home. No, I am looking forward to it because I think it's going to be really fascinating and stimulating, and, you know, to be able to visit some of these spaces again, although obviously the history I'm going to be investigating is quite traumatic.
Yes.
Uh, So that's, well, but it's definitely going to be interesting.
Absolutely. And you mentioned a new book. Can you share what your new project is?
Yeah, so it's called Heiresses, Slavery and the Caribbean Marriage Trade.
Fantastic. And when's that one due out?
Not until at least 2022.
Okay.
So I have to actually, you know, research and write.
Yeah, the fun part, exactly. Fabulous. All right, lucky last. If you could have a superpower, what superpower would you like to have and why?
Well, one might say time travel is a historian. But on the other hand, I think being a woman in pretty much any other time period would be a bit of a nightmare. So I think I'd like to be able to fly. Yeah. I used to have dreams about flying. I think everyone would like to be able to fly.
Yeah, that would be awesome, wouldn't it? And I've dreamt about flying as well, which is, I've flown in dreams, and it's such a strange feeling. And then you wake up and you're like, I can't fly anymore. Damn. So sad. Well, there's one last thing that we do on Talking Tudors, Miranda. We always end with a Tudor takeaway. So our guest shares something for the listeners to go and have a look at. It might be a film, it might be listen to a song or read a book. Or do you have a Tudor takeaway for us?
Oh, I definitely do. It's a very easy question, this one. You must all go and watch Six the Musical.
Oh, yes.
Have you heard about this?
I've heard about it. People have been just raving about it.
It's amazing. I know all the words now. I've seen it 4 times live and I have the soundtrack on my phone. It's my happy music. You know, whenever I'm a bit annoyed by anything, I just play that and sing along and I'm happy again. Wow. It's a song contest. It combines some of the things I love, you know, like Britain's Got Talent, The X Factor, and Tudor history.
And so, Tudor history. So,
in order of preference, no. it's the Six Wives of Henry VIII, and they're having a singing competition to decide which of them has had the worst deal from Henry VIII. So they all sing a song. There's just great banter. The lyrics are hilarious. And there is some real history in there. So I just love it. And the costumes and the music, it's sort of like punk Tudor that they're wearing. Yeah, ruffs, but also kind of silver studs and fishnet tights. I love it. I love it. I'm going to have to go and watch it again. They've started doing sing-along performances.
Oh, that's so fun.
My next treat, hopefully.
Oh, that's fantastic. And do you know what? I have it on good authority for all my Australian listeners that there is an Australian show in production. I don't know any of the details yet, but I'm waiting and I'm hoping that they're going to come to Sydney. I've got my fingers and toes crossed that there'll be a show here. So, watch this space as well, because that'll be awesome. Awesome, awesome.
Yeah, because it was written by these students. So when they were still students, they took it to Edinburgh Festival. And it sort of ballooned from there, and it's on the West End. And I think there's a production just starting in Chicago. So hopefully it will tour the world.
Yes, amazing stuff.
Well, I would also highly recommend a new novel by Kate Morrison called A Book of Secrets, which I had the pleasure to read twice in development. It's fantastic. So it's got a Black Tudor heroine called Susan. She grows up in the countryside. She's a Black Tudor, but she grows up in a Catholic household, which causes problems, and she ends up having to leave that household and move to London, where she marries a printer, but he is Catholic too, so they've got a whole kind of surreptitious printing operation going on, behind the official one, and that also leads her into a lot of intrigue. And obviously there's drama, romance, spying, and it's just great. And because it brings that sort of diverse Tudor London to life in a sort of adventurous and exciting way. You know, she meets people from Portugal, other Africans, lots going on. So I'd highly recommend reading that.
That sounds brilliant. Thank you. Well, Miranda, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. You've got so much going on, and I'm so grateful that you made time to chat with us and talk about your amazing work. And I can't wait to hear all about your trip and your next book.
great. Thanks. Well, it's been great chatting.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tutors. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetutortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family and click on the all-important follow button so you'll never miss an episode. I also invite you to join our Talking Tutors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.